On the morning of September the 28th, internationally known food historian, author, and seed saver of heirloom vegetables, William Wallace Weaver, gave a presentation at the Kentucky Library and Museum. The title of his presentation was An American Appetite, the Material Culture of Food. Timothy Mullen, head of the Department of Library Special Collections, introduced Weaver before his presentation.
He also uses archives and manuscript collections from all over. He's doing work in Cyprus right now. But to put together his books and his publications, he's done, I don't even know how many books, loads of them anyway, on cooking for different types of things. It might be cooking for Christmas time over three centuries, or Pennsylvania Dutch cooking. It might be, you know, a Quaker woman's cooking from a Quaker diary that he used. But he uses historic sources, manuscripts, materials to put together his books, which are wonderful. And I don't need to talk any longer. I'll just introduce William Wallace Weaver, and I'll sit down and be quiet. And he can pick up from here.
Thank you very much for having me here. I really am enjoying my stay. I'm very honored to be your guest. You treated very well, by the way.
Wonderful food and conversation.
What I plan to do this morning is talk about the material food of culture. Perhaps I should define what I mean by that. And I'm going to do this through archival materials. So I'm not going to look at things so much as paper and how to reconstruct pictures, ephemera, cookbooks, and that sort of thing, and what we can learn about the culture of food that way. On the screen in front of you is a picture of some ladies in Bath, New York. This picture is apropos for your Victorian exhibit next to us. These ladies are selling candies and sweets to raise money for their missionary work. These are Methodist ladies. And I say ladies with capital L because look at the way they're dressed and the way they're standing and holding their hands, and they're very proper Victorian ladies indeed. But there's a cookbook that stands behind this that they wrote that has the recipes in it for all this food that we're looking at. And if we go upstairs in the vaults of this museum, we can find cut glass dishes and scales, and we can put together this whole scene. So the material culture, what's going on here, is the story about these people, about their church, about their town, their community, the things on the table. So it's food sort of narrating its own history for us. I think food reveals its stories to us in two basic ways. We can learn empirically from the material itself. I'll give you examples of this as we go, without any kind of supporting documentation, or by decoding written and printed sources about food with the help of oral tradition. And for me, the ideal research combines both methods. I'm doing a work on tourism in Pennsylvania, and for example, I wanted to know what the Old Order Mennonites thought about the use of their images and Amish images in food advertising, so I got them to agree to be recorded. We sat in a room with an extended family, all the in-laws on both sides, and I put a tape recorder in the middle, and we talked for 2 hours. So that's where you take oral tradition and kind of mix it with what you're getting from paper and advertising and that kind of thing. Henry Glasser is a well-known name in folklore studies. He did a book on the material culture of the eastern United States, and he talks about culture hearts, and I really like that image when it comes to food. Culture hearts for Henry were the Massachusetts Bay Area, southeastern Pennsylvania, lowland Carolina, coastal Georgia, the Creole settlements in Louisiana, that sort of thing. These are initial settlement areas which created cultural identities early on, and then these things spread across the map. So taking a food from one of those culture hearths, the mush muffins, which moved around a lot, these started out in the Delaware Valley and then moved down to the Appalachian Mountains and came down this way. But the empirical approach would be to make the mush muffins on a hanging griddle, in an open hearth, using traditional cooking methods. You don't have anybody to interview. You've got you've got some very scanty recipes, but you reconstruct this thing, you keep doing it until you get it right. So what you're looking at are half-baked mush muffins. I did this myself on my own heart after many trial and errors. We use Menominee flour corn, which is a traditional flour corn that was used in our part of the country, and the hanging griddles from about 1780. So there you've got material artifacts, cultural artifacts that you're pulling together to recreate this kind of food. I don't have anybody to interview, you see, they're all gone in the 18th century, so this is one of the things you have to deal with. Or you can go back to your archival materials, and we can talk about that Menominee flour corn and how it was prepared to make the mush muffins. And this is a woodcut from 1836 showing hominy blocks in Potter County, Pennsylvania. I'm sure there must have been a hominy block somewhere near that log house that you've got out front. Because this was a very important tool for making the food you ate on the frontier. And if you don't know what this is, let me explain. It's a tree stump that's been hollowed out, and he has a sapling that he's attached another log to, and he's pounding up and down on this using the sapling to help pull the thing back up, so he's not working so hard. But then we've got a big basket beside there, and we've got a wooden bowl, so we've got a lot of artifacts that are depicted here. That's a corn storage basket. So we've got some things here that are telling us a little bit more about the material culture of the production of the cornmeal that would have gone into these mush muffins. Looking at other types of archival material for learning about foodways or customs, we're looking at the Bœuf à la Mode. This was a famous restaurant in Paris. It opened in 1792. It was very popular with the English visitors to Paris. So there are a lot of travel accounts about Englishmen going to Paris and eating here. There's documentation about the restaurant that way. There are no Englishmen in this picture. These are all French. But what do we learn from looking at this? Well, first of all, the waiter is serving food a la Russe very early in time. This is the food cut up into small servings and brought from the kitchen, as opposed to bringing a whole roast out and carving it there by the table. The gentleman removes their swords before they sit down. You see a sword hanging from the peg on the wall. Some ladies have their hats on, some ladies have their hats off. The cashier has her bonnet on. Probably she's very proud of this hat, so she doesn't want to take it off. What you would never see in America in this period is the mixture of women and men sitting together at the same tables. Even in Philadelphia in the 1880s, the very finest restaurants had separate rooms. Ladies went, there was a gentleman's entrance and a ladies' entrance. Ladies and children ate separate from the men. In fact, in Philadelphia, eventually I'm going to do a history of the foods there. If a woman was, this is in the city regulations in 1821, if a woman was found in an oyster cellar, she was arrested immediately for prostitution. It was just assumed that that's the reason she was there. So you see there, gentlewomen didn't go out in public and eat, so that's why there was a whole catering industry standing behind it. But anyway, this is France, and this is the kind of thing we can learn from the pictures like that. And by the way, it's 2:30 p.m. on the clock, so they're eating their main meal of the day in the middle of the day. I'm going to bounce back and forth. This is sort of a zigzag history also through American food and food ways. The whole material culture of food in flight. This is a whole interesting area to me. And I wonder if anyone has actually interviewed people who flew on airplanes and ate dinners back in the 1930s, if anyone thought to do that. Or who's collecting the trays and the plates and all the artifacts that were that went with this type of meal preparation. And by the way, I have another picture from this same airplane which shows the kitchen, and there's an actual chef with a stove in the back of the plane cooking food, just like on a railroad. And by the way, the interiors of these airplanes seem to be modeled on railroad cars. Look at the overhead bins, they're nets. And anyhow, I find this kind of photography now is the only thing we've got, unless we can find some people who actually survived this. Oh, by the way, I've been collecting material on Zeppelins, you know, the big dirigibles that went around the world, and they had extraordinary meals on these. So there's a whole, there's a museum now in Germany devoted to the whole material culture, the plates, the silverware, the wine, and everything that they served in these, when the people flew. Of course, that was a very expensive form of travel in those days. I'm interested in the people who began to give voice to an American identity in food. And one of them was Eliza Leslie. She is a very interesting person. She never married, and she lived in a hotel in Philadelphia. So she was always this very large, opinionated lady at the edge of society, because the high society ladies in Philadelphia didn't really know how to deal with this woman who was making a living by selling cookbooks and putting her name on the books. It wasn't a lady from Philadelphia or something like that. She came from a well-to-do family that then they lost their money, so she turned to writing cookbooks, and she wrote a lot of books. I've listed some there for you, where she includes an enormous amount of material on American recipes from all over the country. So she is a very good source if you're looking at middle-class urban cuisine, because this is the kind of food that she was interested in promoting. The big question about Miss Leslie, however, is how did she do any of this recipe testing? Because she lived in a hotel in a room without a kitchen. So there is someone else standing behind her story who is doing the actual recipe testing for these the books that she wrote. This painting, the original painting, is in the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. It's by Sully. And in one, she has a lot of books on morality and how to behave. And so it's a great source of information aside just from recipes. But in one of her books, she talks about if you're chubby and overweight, there are certain ways you can dress, like wearing a bonnet with flowers on the side and a large bow underneath to hide the double chin. She goes through all of this rigmarole, and that's exactly what she did in her pictures, because she was herself a very plump lady. The cookbook is cultural artifact. I like these paperback cookbooks written by sort of anonymous women up in the country, because they really have a lot of interesting material in them from the period. This one, Skillful, misspelled, housewife's book by Mrs. Abel, who actually lived in Cato, New York. This is upstate New York. And anyway, 1846. This is a recipe in her book for martinis, which is a plant from the coast. It grows in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, down along the Gulf of Mexico. And you take pods and you cook them like okra when they're young. You will never find this type of recipe in a high-class cookbook, a high-class American cookbook, and never in a European cookbook. So we begin to see these Americanisms showing up in the literature of the period. By the way, the woodcut is not from the cookbook. It is from the seed catalog from the same period, because martinis were just coming in the 1840s, and a lot of people didn't know what they were, so they had to have pictures in the seed catalogs. Is there American cookery? Well, this is a question I like to ask, and we've kicked that one around for a long time. One way to look at American cookery is to look at it from afar. So I have been looking at cookbooks in England and France, and what they say about us. And I found this one quite amusing. Again, it's by an American lady. And it turns out this American lady married an Englishman who was an importer of American foods. But the big thing here with this cookbook is the image of American dishes and how to cook them, but it's printed like a label on a can. So now we have the British image of American cookery is that we eat everything out of cans. There are regional recipes in this book, but let's remember in this period that food in cans was expensive. So we're talking about a luxury food at this particular time. Army rations aside, because it's a different sort of thing. Regional cookbooks, I know you've got them from down here. There's some Kentucky cookbooks very early on. This is an example from South Jersey. One is a Quaker cookbook, the 1940 2014. One is for fundraiser for an orphanage. The other one is a Methodist cookbook from Vineland, New Jersey. But they share a lot of common recipes from the Delaware Valley, and a lot of parsnip and ham recipes, which was one of the folk foods, that warming word, folk. Who is folk? Who determines who's folk? But anyway, popular rural food from the our area, we ham and parsnips with a mustard dressing. So if you want to reconstruct this dish, then you think to yourself, what are all the implements involved? How is it served? Well, it's a country dish. It's a one-pot dish, so it's probably just going to be in a redware platter in the middle of the table, and everybody helps themselves. In pecking order, of course, is important at the table. We can do the same thing with modern, contemporary images that I like to analyze this type of thing with my students at Drexel, where I teach food studies courses. This is not an advertisement for the consumer. Retail. This is an advertisement for chefs. This is from a professional cooking magazine. But what stands behind this? What makes this Conagra food easy? Well, it's all petroleum-based. We can get into the whole politics of that, but you know, the food production is petroleum-based, the food packaging, the subsidized agriculture that brings the unit price down, and this is why you get this type of food in your chains. There's a strip out here outside of town where you've got all of these chains. The reason they're in business is because of the low cost of petroleum and the pre-packaging. This is food to be sold in restaurants. It's pre-packaged. All you have to do is microwave it, which is what you're getting a lot of in these chain stores. But this brings down the unit cost so that they can hire people for minimum wage or less. You see, this whole thing can be deconstructed. We're getting into politics and the economics of food, but this is the kind of thing you can learn when you start studying images about food. The material of culture of food also includes paintings. And this is a painting from Mexico by a Mexican artist. And probably this is an ideal picture for anyone trying to reconstruct the what was a kitchen like in the southwest of the United States, where you had Mexican Americans. The kind of equipment that they used in the kitchens, the raised hearth, as you see there. Lady in the front is grinding cornmeal. There's a big water jar where they kept the water. See the big one on the left? That's for water, so they have a water supply. The sad thing that I really like pottery, and I collect a lot of ceramics. The sad thing about all of this is that it's lead glazed. So these people are actually causing a lot of illnesses, unseen problems with their livers and what have you, by using this very type of pottery. But that was years ago, and maybe they died of other things from lead, aside from lead poisoning. But in any case, I also like this picture because I like to ask my students at Drexel, what's ethnic? Who's ethnic? Are the Mexicans really ethnic? Because, or are they just another kind of Americans? They were here before we were, remember that? That takes us into the whole imaging of food in advertising and in cookbooks and ethnic cooking, if you will, quote unquote. I chose this on purpose because these are cornmeal flatbreads, roughly equivalent to our American Johnny Cakes, which were everywhere in New England, in the center states, in the south, made from different kinds of cornmeal. Here they are presented on earthenware griddles, so some of them were actually baked on this. But this is cookbook imagery, and we see a lot of this today in our cookery books, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because photography, food photography, is part of this whole material culture of food. And also it plays on a lot of the myths that we pick up, the oral and printed ideas that form our ideas about food. And actually, this type of food photography is travelogue. It is taking you to Colombia while you're sitting there in your armchair. And unfortunately, this is changing the whole nature of cookbook as a research tool, as you will see here. Lois Ellen Frank is a Native American, and I don't know whatever possessed her to write this cookbook, because it is absolute target practice for anybody who wants to analyze American food and where it's going today. The basic idea here is that these cornmeal gnocchi are totally inedible if you try to make them. They're nasty. The only thing about it that's good is the pepper sauce that saves them. So essentially what you have here is a picture that's advertising Hopi-decorated plates, because that's about all you can do with this. As in the... Oh, you see, it doesn't really... That kind of mind game that they played in the previous picture is the same kind of thing you see in Victorian food presentation. All you have here is a poached salmon, a dead fish on a platter. It has a little crenellation of puff pastry at the bottom, and beyond that you build up these heaps of truffles and crayfish. And I think there are mushrooms inlaid with truffles, and then silver spears, you know, and on you go. How do you really eat this thing? It was a sideboard dish in Philadelphia Grand Hotels because it's on their menu, so we know it was there. But I think this is basically show food, because there's nothing pleasant about eating a whole truffle on a fork, even though you're probably eating $500 worth of mushroom. But it's just, we criticize Victorians for all this foolishness, but we're doing the very same thing today. This is part of this material culture of food. And I go back to Ellen Frank and her blue plate special. How do you serve arrowheads? You see what I'm talking about? And she makes this acorn ravioli, Apache acorn ravioli. There's no word in the Apache language for ravioli. On and on we go. This is how you can study some of the food imaging today, which is part of popular culture. Now I'm going to go flip back and show you some real food. This is a blue bean. Shakamaxon means something to Pennsylvanians because this was the treaty oak under which William Penn signed his treaty with the Indians. So there's a lot of historical cultural baggage attached to that. This bean was served by the Delaware peoples when they had treaties. They did not have a written language. So when they made a treaty with another group of people, they had a big dinner. They made mush and they cooked these beans, and so the food itself acted as the document. The memory of that meal acted as the written, instead of the written document. And so every so often, maybe every 10 or 15 years, they'd invite these people back and have another big meal to renew the memory of this, of the things they had promised each other, not to go to war or what have you. So this is a being with a huge amount of cultural baggage to it. We can also look at ethnic caricature. The material culture of food is full of this kind of thing. And I'm only going to give you two examples. This is a cookbook with jokes. We have the Irish cook singing for her plum pudding because the stereotype is all Irish can sing. The marketing ploy is that it's a Christmas book and it was sold in newsstands in New York in 1890. So what we're looking at here is real street culture. This is not a fancy cookbook that you bought in a bookstore. You bought it from people off the street. There may be more to this book, and I have a suspicion there is. If we go to the newspapers in December in 1890 in New York, there may be some vaudeville shows or something on Broadway that tie into this Irish image. I haven't done any research on that, but I've done it with other of these ephemeral type of cookery books, and I've discovered there's a bigger context for this. There was a lot more going on than just this piece of paper floating around in a library. One more, I'll use the Asian, all Chinese can quote Confucius, wise cook makes good cook. Here's a Chinese cookbook that was very popular in the 1930s and 40s. Again, we've got stereotyping here. There isn't anything in this cookbook that a Chinese person would recognize. Chop suey soup, lantern party salad, on and on you go. This is a real Americanization. It's an attempt to make something exotic, something foreign, familiar. So this book is very interesting to study in that one respect. But you see, you find a lot of this in the culinary literature of the period. And then we can go right back to the red, white, and blue. This is food that's used to separate us from them. answer is, the answer to the question is two words, but if you know the question, you're one of us. If you don't, you're an outsider. Apple pie, of course. This postcard was very popular in 1970 when it came out, but it's kind of an icon. Actually, today we could say it's pizza or it's hamburger, but still, you're going to find apple pie wherever Americans go, and you're going to find apple pie in Iraq, you know, at the military, PX, what have you. So standing behind all that more recent stuff, apple pie is still there. It hasn't changed, and you'll see another image of that. The other material culture of food that's interesting to study is the immigrant experience. And I'm not talking about the colonial immigrants, I'm talking about the more recent ones. This is a very interesting trade card, because on the back is the list of all the shipping companies Bank dealt with. What you did, you were an immigrant in Bremerhaven, Germany, you had no money to get to America. This bank had a branch there, they loaned you the money, they made arrangements with the steamship company, you came to America, they found you a job, and you paid back your loan to this bank on interest. So they were really an immigrant job, importation of immigrants job placement agency, the whole nine yards for this. I have a menu from 1868 of an English family coming to Philadelphia, immigrating. And the menu is like this immense piece of paper, maybe 3 feet long, and it starts with what they ate the first night. There were four kids, and the whole record of what they ate during the entire voyage to the United States is recorded on this menu, because they checked off what they needed and they wrote in what they wanted. And four of everything, obviously that's for the kids, mom and dad got a little bit better stuff. And it's a very interesting record, and this kind of material is of interest to people who are studying the whole immigrant thing. I'm also looking at images of immigrants. Here is one. You know, if a movie company wanted to take this family and do a movie about them, we would have, of course, this opening scene with food. And they didn't want to record anything about food. We can't impose our values on them. This is a Hungarian wedding that took place about 1906 in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. They were working in the coal mines. That's why they were there. Coal mines are still there, most of them are abandoned. But they wanted to record the extended family and the fact that they had music and dance. And I'm not going to argue with the mother-in-law. You see, there's mom sitting. She is, you don't mess with her. The bride, by the way, is in the middle, and the tall guy behind mama is the husband. So the husband was about six something. Anyway, and the angry-looking father-in-law is the guy with the handlebar mustache. There's probably a story behind this whole picture, but we won't go there. Another area that I'd like to talk about is all the different revolutions that American cooking has undergone. And one of the most, one that has affected us more than other countries like France or England is the whole business of temperance and the elimination of wine and alcoholic beverages from our diet. And then taking it one step further, there was the whole non-fermentation movement. The idea of this being that if you use yeast in making bread, it produces alcohol when it's fermenting. Therefore, you have alcohol in the bread and you can't eat that. For moral reasons, it's off the table. So what we had was the development of a lot. This is Warner's safe yeast. It's not yeast, it's chemical compound. You have this development in right after the Civil War of all of these yeast substitutes, these powders. And this is the reason why you've got all of these baking powder biscuits in the South and all of these chemically raised foods as opposed to yeast raised. Because Warner Safe Yeast was sold door to door all over the South. The Warner Safe Yeast cookbook, I've got a copy of that. And it's got possum, it's got muskrat recipes. And you can tell right away that this cookbook is for people who live out in the country. This is not for city slickers. It was for the door-to-door salesmen. So this is an advertisement, by the way. It's a little poster almost. I guess it went into a store where they sold the safe yeast in these containers. There were a lot of other products similar to this, but this one is a very good example. Because Warner also sold a patent medicine, which was, by the way, about 99% alcohol, but it was a medicine. And I have a bottle for it. It's shaped like a safe, okay? These are all the artifacts that go with this whole story. But this is just one example. The other change, what comes with all of this chemistry, these chemicals used in our breads and what have you, is the whole evolution of this feather-light bread. I think Wonder Bread that we know today started out as Wonder Flour. And this image is going to go into a book on the history of bread in England, because when they saw this, they were just bowled over by the fact that bread would be sold with this sexism involved. What we have is a girl in red, white, blue, but she's a sexy young maid, and her legs are exposed. This is most unladylike in the Victorian period. Essentially, she's in a can-can dress, so this will tell you right away that even though she probably is good in the kitchen, she probably has other talents. There's a value judgment going on here about women and about the way bread should feel. Bread is lighter than the feather, as you see on the scales. And this flour trademark becomes, of course, eventually a bread trademark. The unspoken truth, the sad thing about processed flour like this, is it's been deprived of most all of its important nutrients. Feather-like bread is essentially air and gluten, and that's why when you buy flour in the store, it says enriched, because the processing has taken out all the nutrients, and they have to put back something into it, so at least it has some food value other than glue. We could look at the whole history of the kitchen and the material culture of preparing food. I'm just going to focus in on one image because it happens also to be in a cookbook. This is the gas stove. This is an advertisement for a gas stove that's in a cookbook from 1884. But who's hooked up to gas? I know in Philadelphia, only a very few downtown families could even afford to have such a stove. But this is not a big stove for a large family. This is a small stove. This is for the third floor walk-up apartment somewhere, perhaps in New York or Boston. This is for actually a small family, or even a bachelor or bachelorette, a Miss Leslie type of person. But the interesting thing about this advertisement is that it shows this stove doing all of its functions at once, which is sort of impossible, or it would drive you crazy to try to cook on it that way. The interesting thing about this particular stove product is that it was only available for about 3 or 4 years, because I found out by doing some research, these stoves tended to explode and kill people. We talked about that American canned food. Well, here you go. Military rations came in cans, but they were cheap because it was government subsidized. Other than that, we've got canned food, which is basically luxury. But this is a nice image because it shows you how canned food was produced and put together and sold in that period. And as you can see, the can itself is wrapped in tissue paper, the way we wrap fancy pears and apples today. The interesting thing about this particular company is that it morphed into the Campbell Soup Company later on in 1921. So this is a soup with a long genealogy, this soup story with a long genealogy, but I'm just using that as a piece of ephemera archival material to show you more about food history. Then we have, in the late 19th century, we've got this turning point, very much anti-foreign. The ladies, the Victorian ladies, wanted to reform American diet. They introduced measuring cups and everything because they want to go into the immigrant neighborhoods and get these people cooking American food, and this is a good way to do it. But you also have cookbooks which turn tables on the whole shift that's going on in American diet at the time. This is 1890s, you've got Chinese restaurants, you've got all sorts of ethnic restaurants in the big cities, but you've got the Colonial Receipt Book in Philadelphia, published by society ladies, raising money for a new wing to the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. And in New England, you've got this Hookham Took Housewife. This is a cookbook that is published on ye old paper to sort of imitate a pilgrim cookbook, if you will. We're going back to this Victorian rose-colored image of the past. And we have it down here. I tried to find a menu in my collection from Kentucky, but I didn't have one that really worked. This works. This is you look at Thanksgiving menus. This is where you learn all about American ideas about who we are and what is considered a proper Thanksgiving meal. This is an interesting one. It's from the Gayoso Hotel in Memphis, and we have the noble ancestor. No turkeys, no pilgrims. This is South. So you're a descendant of a plantation owner, a Virginia gentleman. There he is, right on the menu, if there's any doubt. I tried to deconstruct this whole meal, and we could do that. We could find photographs of the Gayoso Hotel, pictures of the dining room. We could assemble remains of whatever is left of their silver and the china. We could probably, eventually, with a lot of money and time, reconstruct this whole meal that took place in 1887 in this particular hotel. I'll just highlight two things that I found on the menu that I thought interesting. Magnolia hams, which were very well known in the 19th century. They came out of Louisville. They're on the menu. Ham, baked ham with that champagne sauce, came out of Philadelphia. I know the chef that created that whole idea, James Parkinson. Then we've got turkey on the menu. Of course, you have to have turkey because it's Thanksgiving. And this is a Shaker turkey from Pleasant Hill, Kentucky. So here we go, 1887, and they're sourcing their food. You think this is new. You just learn a lot by looking at these old documents. You can also do the same by looking at can labels. Talk about real ephemera. But this is material culture. This is, they come in, you can collect them attached to the original tins, or you can just buy them flat off of eBay, whatever. I look around for this type of material because it's great. Colonial Revival, patriotic themes, Mad Anthony Wayne, lima beans. When the maid is opening this can of lima beans in the kitchen and the little kid is standing there, who's Mad Anthony Wayne? There's a whole story there, Revolutionary War. We get this oral history that's attached to Anthony Wayne. He killed a lot of American Indians, so he's not on everybody's list of great heroes. In any case, lima beans, you're not going to find a can of lima beans in France. This is an American food, and that's why I picked it. It's this Americanness that comes out, and even in this type of product advertising. Lima beans, creamed lima beans are almost on every hotel menu, summer menu, that I have looked at. And so is Jell-O. The interesting thing, you see, I'm moving through time. I'm coming up into the 19-teens and 20s. The Jell-O was really sold as a food for kids, but the literature was directed to mom. The interesting thing here that I want to point out is that this was a commercially produced food, a factory food, that pushed out traditional food. The traditional food being your baked apple, which was probably a lot healthier for them. Not necessarily because Jell-O is actually made from pig's feet and other body parts. You didn't know that? It's not kosher. It's not vegan, trust me. But the thing about it is, in order to make Jell-O palatable to kids, you have to add a lot of sugar to it. So we start upping the sugar in the diet of our children early on. And this is one way it was done. And this is the cover of a cookbook, a Jell-O cookbook. I'm interested in Jell-O because they start the manipulation of females and using women or young girls to start selling food. This is a whole area that is probably of interest to women's studies. But you've got this idealized, innocent little girl selling this pure product. She's a little homemaker, already trained to be somebody's wife. You see, she's bringing out this platter of Jell-O. Also, Jell-O molds were sold, so there's sort of a subtle ad going on there. But these beauty queens show up in the 20s, and this is part of the whole thing. You know, 1918, women get the right to vote, up come the Hems. And then up come the Hems' father and father, as you will soon see. Clabber Girl, this is taking a traditional
Bonnie Clabber, maybe you've heard of this. It's milk that sours and it turns into a junket-like consistency, and that was used a lot in traditional cooking. It's replaced by this Clabber girl, again, artificial leavener, like the safe yeast. It's more of the same. This comes out of Indiana, so this is more of a Midwest thing. I have to mention the Cornflake Crusade because this is where American religion and advertising sort of crossed over. And the Seventh-day Adventists were very good at that because they put cornflakes on the American table. But they used that life-changing moment. I have found Jesus. I am a changed person. I have found cornflakes. I am a changed person. They use this mission, this religious technique of converting people over into advertising. This is very unique to, well, nothing very unique. It is unique to American advertising, and this is the whole formula that we rely on today. Another beauty queen, of course, and that's about Rutledge. But alas, the Seventh-day Adventists didn't really win because we have a lot of parallel things going on. Here's more material culture of food, the whole study of ironware. This is the colonial breakfast skillet, which was patented actually in the 1880s. This is the Victorian idea of what a colonial breakfast should be. Hash browns, eggs sunny side up, good old country slab bacon. The interesting thing about these breakfast skillets is that they were served in saloons, these places of sin. It's a whole meal. It was brought out hot on a board and you ate it there at the bar, standing up. For the temperance people, this colonial breakfast skillet had a negative connotation because it was connected with drinking. But look at this carefully, and if you take the handle off, you've got your TV dinner. The guy that claimed to invent TV dinners, you know, with this compartmentalized plate dish, he needs to do some history, a little renewing on his history studies, because this idea pre-existed, and it was a Victorian American creation. Jell-O Girl grows up. I'm also looking at, here's more archival type materials. These are journals. Baker's, the American Baker, Confectioner's Journal, the Progressive Grocer, that sort of thing. It's very interesting to go in there and see what they say about the cook, about the housewife, about food, and you can understand where a lot of the advertising is coming from in this period. Now, what we have here is a very attractive young woman. There are no shopping carts, so she can't carry it. She can't push it out to her car. She is emancipated. She's got no servants waiting on her. But most of the food that she's carrying is all prepackaged, if you'll notice. There's not a lot of fresh stuff there. That's a very interesting point. And then we move on. Once those hems came up, we get a lot of sex in advertising and food imaging. And this magazine called Hot Dog is for regular fellows monthly. It was published in Ohio. It's a girly magazine. I mean, it's raunchy. I needn't tell you anything more, but I think the cover says it all. We see more and more of it. Wait, I'm glad you're sitting down because we're going to look at some menus. These are menu covers, by the way. And the artist who did the Paris Inn Naked Ladies was a woman, so okay. It's not all male chauvinism involved here. But when Prohibition really, I think people couldn't drink, but there was the sex stuff that kept coming up. So this pot had a tight lid on it, and when the lid came off in 1933, you could follow this all across the board in American cooking. You get an explosion of this type of thing all over the United States. The French casino was eventually shut down in New York, I think about 1940, because, well, prostitution, drugs, and all that, but it was owned by the mafia, so, you know, the feds were keeping their eye on that. But the ladies on the floor show, that's the way they dressed. A couple of feathers and pearls. I'm not going to belabor this whole subject of sex and food. The Germans have a very good saying. They say, food is the sexuality of old age. So we'll just leave it on that. This is a California Berkeley Frisco magazine, and they take this several steps beyond where I want to go today. But I'll just leave it at that. War is a big issue. We're moving up in time. I'm looking at the material culture changing points in American history, and war is one of them. We could look at the Civil War, we could look at World War I, but World War II was really a very major changing point for us, and those of us who are alive today, because we've got parents who can talk about the hard times they had, how they had to save money to buy a house after the war, and all that kind of thing. So there's a huge amount of literature out there that you can explore. And the whole, Mamie Eisenhower tea parties. And by the way, Eisenhower, I was telling someone yesterday, President Eisenhower was the only president I know of who actually had cookery as a hobby. And I have some pictures of him in Mamie's aprons. He's doing pancakes. He created a vegetable soup that was made for fundraisers when he did, he was running for political office. He would show up, he paid $500 for Ike's vegetable soup. I don't think there's any other president that is so sure of himself, if you want to put it that way, as Eisenhower was. He had no qualms about going out in front of the public with an apron on. No other president has done that that I know of. So it wasn't all a desert. We had a foodie as a president, look at it that way. I just want to touch on this obesity problem that we've got today. There's a long history behind this. If you go into the material culture of imaging people and food, I just want to use this picture of the Chester White pig, because we have a lot of problems today, issues about genetically modified animals and the morality of all that, but we've been tinkering with animals for a long time. That is exactly the way this boar looked. That is not an exaggeration. These pigs were raised for lard. They were just walking blubber, and they could hardly move. But that's just thought I'd show you this. I have a wonderful advertisement from Lancaster of a very rotund gentleman being fitted for clothes, and there's a skinny man on the other side. This is 1880s. And of course, the rotund man has a watch fob, and he's got all the accoutrements of a successful businessman, and the lanky guy, the young greenhorn, is just, he's not there yet. He hasn't arrived. So,
I'm sorry, what was this advertisement?
This is about 1885. I was asked about the date of this particular picture. This image was used a lot in trade cards, so this millinery company used it in Allentown, but it's you'll find it all over the map. Just go on eBay and look up Chester White Boar, and you'll find more of these cards. Moving down in time, I like to analyze this. This is popular culture today. The important point that we want to make about Mona Lisa on the right, the chunky Mona, is that our chunky home-style food. You see, this is home cooking. The chunkiness has been is a positive thing in this advertising ad. So there is the chunky papa on the right-hand side eating his chunky. But anyway, it's a manipulation of body image, and we've gone, I show this to you because we have this type of imaging now, which is very, this is a postcard. I collect all kinds of junk that I can find. And it's even better than this, because look in the back, cable bombing. Those are bowling alleys. So, there's a whole other level of stuff. This is high pitch in German. Edelkitsch. But this wouldn't even be funny in the 1930s or 40s. Today it is, because we get the joke. But using body image this way, and food, beer in this case, is another thing we can look at. It's part of popular culture today in any event. But then we have the calorie wars, and anorexia is just as fashionable today as being a little bit on the hefty side. I don't know how this ever made it in to food arts, but it's spa food, and you can eat this for breakfast, and you know, lunch and dinner, and you haven't even gone over 500 calories, so you can look like an AIDS patient within about 3 weeks' time. This isn't really very funny, but this is the kind of stuff you find in literature today, and this is what's helping kick into a lot of what's going on out there in the food disorder side of things. But this is from a magazine for professional cooks. I just only want to ask the back bottom question, how do you eat raw cactus? You know, you should analyze food pictures more critically when you look at them and think about what's going on here. What's the story it's telling me? I'm finishing up here, but here's our apple pie again, but in a different, completely different context. This is also 1907. Now, that guy didn't pose with his apple pie because he was promoting American cooking. He's a graduate pastry chef, and he got his portrait taken. But this ends up on the cover of Food Arts. By the way, it's a magazine I recommend you read, not because it's the Bible of truth, but because it's full of all this incredible crap that you can analyze, because they consider themselves the cutting edge of the food world. I mean, the world, with a capital W. So I'm just going to finish here. Are we... They asked the question back on their 10th anniversary, how far have we come in America with food? Do we have an American cuisine? Is there American identity? Blah, blah, and all of that. So is there American cuisine today? I think maybe what we're talking about are several kinds of cookeries on different social levels in different parts of the country, because if you scrape away the veneer of this mass-produced stuff, you'll start to find pockets of things buried here and there, talking to people in the country. You can still, for example, go up in the area of Lower Berks County, Pennsylvania, and everybody's still cooking with hickory nuts. They're in the markets up there. I'm talking about little things like this, which are part of the traditional culture of these different regions. So I will finish there. With questions. That is not a real baby, it's a doll. I asked the photographer. As I said, I collect junk. So this is just a pass-out card, you know, for an iPhone. That was sort of a quick sprint through just how to look at material culture food through paper. But there are a lot of other ways to do it. This is only one avenue. So I throw the floor open to questions. Is that one?
I bake bread at breakfast, so we use a safe instant yeast. My question is, because when you pour it out, it looks like yeast, and it's got an old-looking chef on it, you know, and it says safe instant. So I was wondering if that's just, you know, come from...
I don't know this product, this safe instant yeast. It could be a type of yeast that's been processed in a way, but I don't know. It could be non-yeast altogether, something chemical.
Yeah, I was wondering if they're making non-yeast that looks like yeast.
I'm sure they are, because they're making eggs that aren't eggs, or butter that's not butter. I mean, there are all kinds of commercial products out there. Meat that's not meat, fish that's not fish. Yes.
One of your interests is heritage seeds. How do you merge the idea of, you know, preserving seeds and food? Or is there a connection there?
I gave a talk about this yesterday. This is the idea of the heirloom seeds. I tried to go down a different track here because I don't only wear one hat. But I don't divide the kitchen garden from the kitchen. To me, I take a holistic approach. You can't have cooks without gardeners. You can't have food without seeds. You know, it's all part of a bigger story. So, going back to that slide that I showed of the Menominee flower corn, we could do a whole talk about saving seed, Menominee flower corn. How do you grow it in your garden? And you know, there's a whole story behind that. I just interleave the stuff. I tried to make two distinct talks today, you know, coming down here. But in school, I have a lot more overlapping. I don't know. Have I answered your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
You had two different interests.
Yeah.
They're actually one.
They're actually one.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have this bistro garden at school, and so I have to emphasize the plants for that class. I'm doing a book on the medieval foods of Cyprus, so okay, there's another lecture. I'll come back and talk about Cyprus in 3 years. How's that? The thing about the food world is it's like Hollywood. If you're a good clown, you become a clown the rest of your life. And I did books on Pennsylvania Dutch country cooking, so I became the Pennsylvania Dutch cooking expert. I've got a lot more interests than that. Food is about people, and people are all over the world.
You mentioned the fast food restaurants and stuff, but when you go to Williamsburg, or isn't there a place called the Tavern in Philadelphia that emphasizes fresh food? They don't have refrigeration. My question is, do even these authentic restaurants still use manufactured food?
In Colonial Williamsburg, absolutely. I've been there, and I've gone from place to place. In Philadelphia, yes, we have that. Your question had two parts. We do have lots of restaurants that have fresh and only fresh food on the menu. White Dog Cafe would be a good example of that. Only organic. And all, I would say most of the better line of restaurants in Philadelphia also have vegetarian selections on their menus. You don't have to go to a vegetarian restaurant to get vegetarian food. It's so mainstream now. I was talking yesterday about a French three-star restaurant in Paris. I interviewed the chef, and in 2001, he completely dropped meat from his menu. He just does vegetables. He bought two farms. He's biodynamic. They farm with horses. They do everything by hand. And everything from the farms goes into the restaurant. Nothing is bought from anybody else. He sources his own food. Of course, it's, 470 euros, fixed price for one person for dinner. But he has his 3 stars, so that's awesome. So this vegetable, it's heirloom vegetables that he's using. So, I mean, this thing is coming. The wave is headed towards us, and it's going to be a tsunami when it hits us. This whole idea of putting vegetables as the main dish on the table is something you're going to see more and more of.
Where do you think that we're going to see increasingly large percentages of the genetically engineered in terms of either?
No, I think the problem is, and it's just now coming out, last week there was an article in the New York Times about that, the hybridized, these packet vegetables, the genetically engineered food that we're eating is nutritionally, in some cases, 30% less nutritious than the old heirloom or open pollinated traditional varieties of food. This nutrition thing, if they can resolve that, yes, but there are a lot of other problems. European Union is going to absolutely, totally ban any kind of genetically modified food, and a lot of other countries are doing the same thing. So our farmers aren't going to be able to export it, so it's just going to be an economic thing. And with patenting vegetables, you know, creating these hybrids, that then you patent the variety, there are enough plant geneticists out there who can reproduce that particular vegetable. It looks like it, it tastes like it, it acts like it in the field. There's no point in patenting it even, because I breed plants, I know how this works. So the plants, the crops that have been developed for genetically modified crops, they were developed not to be more nutritious, but to respond to certain chemicals that are sprayed on them, or fertilizers that go with them. Monsanto was not a seed company. It was a chemical company that made sprays and fertilizers, and then they realized they need to develop plants that are compatible with that. But the problem is, the plants don't take up nutrients from the soil the way natural food does, organically raised food does. So we don't get any of the nutrients from the soil. These magnesium and all these things that our body needs to digest, digest and absorb our nutrition from the food that we eat. So there's a big problem coming up the line. And by the way, the geneticists have discovered that you can't take gene A and put it in over here and make and make something new out of it, because genes don't act alone. They act in unison with maybe 500 or 600 other genes. And so what we've been saying all along is that these modified plants, we really don't know what we're doing. We don't know what the side effects are, and that's precisely what has been proven. So I don't know what's going to happen with this, but I can tell you, they've got to go back to the drawing board. So it's an expensive mistake right now.
So you think that's even true in terms of when they're feeding them? I mean, and I'm from the Midwest originally, and of course a lot of that is grown specifically to feed out cattle and things, and I know they've had problems where sometimes some of this genetically modified corn has gotten into human food consumption, I guess, versus animal consumption versus...
Yeah, but if you're eating the pigs that ate it,
you're still getting it.
You
think it's
well, I know that there's a hushed up scandal in Iowa right now where a farmer was feeding genetically modified corn to his pigs, and he was getting, the pigs were aborting their piglets. 90% of the sows were losing their piglets because of this corn. So if that gets into the food system, what's it going to do to people? I mean, is it going to neuter us? I don't know. That's just, you know, that's another issue. I didn't come down here to talk about that. Because we hash it over at Drexel, but we take both sides of the issue. One of my engineering students actually did, for his midterm, an incredible paper on this whole genetically modified thing. And I'm going to use his paper in my classes because it's so good. It just puts it all out there. Anyway, I think we're trying to talk about the material culture of food, but I mean, it's all related, let's face it.
Aside from genetically produced vegetables, there's this whole culture of growing the biggest pumpkin or the biggest, zucchini or something like that. And I was wondering if you researched at all, like how far that goes back, or whether people were doing that maybe in Victorian era?
Yeah, they were doing that. This is the question was about raising these oversized fruits and vegetables. This is definitely an American thing. And it goes back to the Victorian period when bigger was better. And you can trace this in the seed catalogs. The seed companies actually gave out awards to people for the biggest tomato. And you would send it in, and a lot of advertising. The biggest strawberry, the biggest cantaloupe, the biggest watermelon, and that kind of thing. From a personal point of view, I think this is ridiculous, because what does size have to do with flavor? And anyway, if I had a giant strawberry, I'm going to chop it up in a pie. So what difference, what does the size matter in any case? You've got these big field pumpkins now, these monsters. They always put a little child on top because it makes them look bigger in the photography. But, I mean, it's just wasted food. We've gotten into this whole culture where food is now, particularly with industrialized agriculture, food is no longer has soul. It's not part of our life cycle. It's a commodity that we've bought. So there's a huge amount of waste. And I really resent that. I mean, that's my own feeling about that. And I can get on my high horse about that and lecture you for hours about how I feel. But it all goes back to this side. Big is not better, but never mind. People get awards for these potatoes, big squash or pumpkins. And they're not really culinary pumpkins. These field pumpkins that are orange were really for fodder, for cattle. They were meant for the New England field pumpkin was a pumpkin fed to dairy cattle. It has no taste because they didn't want the milk to have any taste of pumpkin. But the milk got the beta carotene, it got this color to it, because they were going to turn that into cream into butter and get lots of money for that high-end, beautifully colored butter. And anyway, that's another thing. Yes?
Going along with judging agriculture, I have a friend who judges milk fairs and homemade things like that. Because I know that they don't even necessarily do it to judge the milk itself, they add things to the milk to see if
it's done. Oh, well, I've never been to one of those, but I know they do it at the farm show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania farm show is really big. People all over, and they come from down here to go up there and show off their pigs and their cows and everything. I don't know. To me, milk tasting would be more educational if we were trying
milk, different types of milk cows who have been foddered in different ways. One of the reasons Chester County butter was so famous in Pennsylvania in the 19th century is because of the type of grass that would be terroir, is what the French call it. It's what makes the wine taste the way it does. Well, it applies across the board to all food. What's in the soil, because that affects the flavor of the food. But I don't know anything about this other wine, I mean, milk tasting thing. Oh, I've gone to olive oil tastings. I mean, you know, it's all out there. Garlic tastings, if you really want to lose friends quickly, do a garlic tasting. Eat 30 types of garlic in one day. It's with you for weeks. More questions? No? Well, thank you for your patience.